Howdy, I'm Eric from Antioch, California.
Hey, I'm Kevin from Victor, New York.
I'm Luke from Seattle.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. If you watched Saturday Night Live at all in the early 2000s, you probably saw Rachel Dratch. When she got out of that all-consuming job, she started dating. And in her new memoir, she talks about some of the horrible dates she went on with a guy who was full of himself, a guy who drank too much, a guy who bragged about eating horse meat.
I mean, I went on some normal dates, too, but those normal dates don't make for a funny story. So you write about the ones that, you know, something was a little off about.
It's Bullseye. This week, Rachel Dratch walks into a bar, meets a guy, and 6 months later, she's pregnant. We find out how it happened. Not literally, it's not like a birds and the bees thing. Plus, the creators of the comedy TV show Eagleheart talk about their primary inspiration, Walker, Texas Ranger, and about working with the show's star, the great Chris Elliott. And contributor Jordan Morris returns to tell America what's good and what's bad in the form of a completely arbitrary ranking. All that and more this week on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Every week on the show, we're joined by one of my favorite culture critics for some tips as to what is worth your time in the world of culture. This week, I'm joined by Jason Kottke, the proprietor of Kottke.org, one of the world's greatest collections of links to great things on the internet. I've heard it called the New Yorker of links to things on the internet. He joins me from his office in New York. Hey, Jason, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing, Jesse?
I'm doing okay. Let's start with this list of the 50 greatest cartoons as selected by animation professionals that was put together by Jerry Beck. Tell me about it.
What's interesting about the list is that most of them were made in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And this is a list that was put together in 1994. You know, very Warner Brothers heavy, also Disney, and they're still great.
A lot of these you can get to on the internet, whether by hook or by crook. Many of them are on YouTube and stuff.
Yes. The top one, the number one thing on the list is What's Opera Doc? And I couldn't find that one on YouTube anywhere, but Duck Amuck is the second one. It's a Daffy Duck cartoon. Was able to find that one and a couple more.
Look, Mac, just what's going on around here? Let's get organized, hmm? How about some scenery? That's dandy. Ho, ho, that's rich, I'll say. Now how about some color, stupid? Hey! Not me, you swap artist!
There's really not a lot of things that are funny from, you know, 60, 70, I'm trying to do the math in my head, 70-ish years ago that still play today. I mean, even, you know, even the greatest comedies of the 1940s and 50s feel a little awkward in a modern context. And, you know, a lot of these, especially the Looney Tunes stuff, is just absolutely every bit as hilarious now as it was then.
Yeah, I mean, they're just really good. They were really well done, and you can see the craft put into not only the animation, but the storytelling.
Let's talk about what the Space Shuttle Booster saw. First of all, tell us what this is.
This is a video. It's about, I don't know, it's about 10 or 15 minutes long. And it shows, they stitched it together from a bunch of cameras that are mounted all over the space shuttle. I think they did it over a couple of missions. And it's HD video, and it shows the shuttle launching, going up, and it shows the boosters. The boosters at about 29 miles up, they come off because the fuel is spent. They come off, and then it shows them gradually, you know, pinwheeling their way back to Earth and eventually splashing down in the ocean.
We've seen a lot of pictures from space, but actually sound is a big part of what's so cool about this one.
Yeah, I mean, the sound is amazing on this thing. Apparently they had Skywalker Sound remaster it, So they took out all the audio junk, and you just hear, you know, what it sounds like to ride on the space shuttle, you know, if you were clinging to the rocket booster.
It sounds like a fiery death, I think, if you're clinging to the rocket booster.
Yeah. But it's interesting, you sort of get to hear, you know, not what outer space sounds like, but the upper atmosphere, what it sounds like. And it sounds sort of like this, like a whale swimming in a tin can or something. It's very atmospheric, you know, sort of a whistling and a humming. It's really great to watch this video with the sound, you know, turned up on the headphones. You can really, you know, you can really hear everything.
It seems like a really wonderful example of the kind of video that the web is made for. It's something that you can choose to watch. It's small and it's just jaw-dropping.
And it's interesting because this video it's not a short video. It's not your typical like viral hit that lasts, you know, the video is a minute and a half or whatever. This is, you know, I think it's like a 10 or 15 minute video, and it's compelling for those 10 or 15 minutes.
Jason Kottke from Kottke.org recommends Jerry Beck's list of the 50 greatest cartoons as selected by animation professionals and what the space shuttle booster saw. You can find links to those Kottke.org posts on our website, MaximumFun.org. Just click on Bullseye. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. To call Eagle Heart a parody of 90s action shows like Walker, Texas Ranger is to sell it short, because it is much, much, much stranger than that. And why wouldn't it be? It stars Chris Elliott, the man who twisted the sitcom around itself on Get a Life and who's made a mockery of the talk show on Letterman for years. A typical episode features the crime-fighting team, Chris Elliott and two other agents, played by Maria Thayer and Brett Gelman, going into hiding after witnessing a murder by the Albanian mob. They accidentally claim to be swingers. Then they end up in a swingers club. They take a managerial role in the swingers club, retrofit it with theme rooms, which increase business by 40%, discover that swingers are secretly plotting to take over the U.S. government, then pit the swingers against the mob in a nightmarishly brutal final burst of murderous violence. And all of that happens in 11 minutes. That's actually a pretty normal episode, relatively speaking. One episode features an evil stomach growth with its own brand of snack treats. My guests are the show's co-creators, Michael Komen, Andrew Weinberg, and Jason Wolliner. Let's listen to a scene from the show. The three leads are looking for criminals in an abandoned warehouse, and Elliot is explaining why he became a marshal.
I hope you don't mind me asking, Chris, but why'd you come back?
A vision, Susan. Might even say a ghost. You see, I had another life before I was a marshal. I had a bride, more beautiful than a limited edition Thomas Kincaid. Soon she was Mitch's child, but something went wrong. She died during childbirth, so I raised the boy alone. I called him Gaby, and then... Oh, look, there's our guy. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yeah. Well, one day I came home, and I found that Gaby had been brutally slaughtered. The next day, I applied to be a U.S. Marshal to track down his killer. But every now and then, Gaby's sweet little ghost pops up to remind me just why I got into this crazy biz in the first place.
Michael, Andrew, Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It is a pleasure to have you. So, Michael and Andrew, the two of you work together on the Conan O'Brien television program.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where the idea for this operation was born?
The very, very earliest idea kind of came out of that, because we were working on the Walker, Texas Ranger lever. So Andrew and I spent hours and hours watching episodes of that show.
We can play a clip of the Walker Texas Ranger lever, but I think you need to explain what the Walker Texas Ranger lever is for people who were not
Yes, Conan just wanted a way to ridicule the show, and so we thought that just showing straight clips of it was the best way. And he would yank on a colorful handle, and all of a sudden a clip would start playing on screen.
That's right. As you may know by now, all I have to do is pull that lever, and we will be treated to a classic clip of now NBC-owned Walker, Texas Ranger, and we pay nothing. That's the sweet part of the whole deal. That is my favorite Walker episode. He goes to a nursing home and beats the crap out of everybody.
I mean, there was a thing we shot for the pilot that was really taken from an episode where they had, I think a woman and her kid had been held. Like, there's constant hostage holding and of what by white supremacist groups because they can't, they didn't want to say like Muslims. And so they would just like skinheads were doing everything. And so I think some people were being, a kid, mom and her kid were being held hostage. And then Walker like threw a gun through an air vent and they like shot their way out or something. And then they're thanking Walker at the end, and they say, like, thank you so much, Walker. And he goes, well, don't thank me. Thank the Second Amendment and good men like Sam Brownback who are sworn to defend it. And it was just like I'd never seen that kind of, like, overt political endorsement on a show. It was just like that doesn't exist anywhere. And I thought that kind of thing is, like, a good, like, loathsome trait.
You guys have watched astonishing volumes of Walker, Texas Ranger, because you had to pull clips for the Walker, Texas Ranger lever. So tell me what you, besides the fact that it was an odd, you know, ideological exercise, Walker, Texas Ranger, what do you think is, what did you like about the show? And what did you like about Chuck Norris as a performer? Was there anything that you found interesting or compelling?
No, I mean, honestly, I always thought that it was just bad all the way through. But I think the one thing that if there's something I liked about him, he showed up one day to do a live sketch with Conan, like at the end of when we were doing the lever. And I didn't get the slightest sense that he ever thought he had been made fun of, that he was just friendly and he just couldn't have been more accommodating about doing like where do I stand and how do I do this stuff? And I was really thought like we've like been working for like a year to ridicule you, and I genuinely wanted him to feel bad about the show he made. And he was so obvious that he just couldn't touch it. He like you could not make that man frown. You couldn't make him. You couldn't hurt him.
Good work, guys. Just keep those Walker, Texas Ranger clips coming. Who knew I could host this show just by pulling a lever?
Oh. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, Conan. Something funny?
No. I was just talking about Walker, Texas Ranger. That's all. It was a great show.
Yeah, I think so. 8 years isn't too shabby.
Yeah. It's a long time on the air, 8 years. Mm-hmm. Say goodnight, Norris!
No, you say goodnight, Conan.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guests are the co-creators of the action comedy series Eagle Heart, which stars Chris Elliott and airs on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. Here's a not atypical opening scene from an episode of the program. The team of three U.S. Marshals are hanging out around the table at a poker game while what we presume to be a friend regales them with a colorful tale.
So I look in the back seat, and what do I see? A boa constrictor looking right back at me. And I look over at Whitey, and I go, Whitey, next time we go to the hardware store, let me pick out the garden hose.
Man, I just love our weekly poker games.
Yeah, right?
Wait a minute. We don't have a weekly poker game.
Die, pigs!
I was just watching clips of Chris Elliott on the Letterman show, which I think you guys are all about the right age to have either grown up watching that or grown up with the at least the legacy and legend of watching that. What do you remember most about Chris Elliott as a young performer?
I mean, it's everything he does is sort of a different version of his kind of Chris Elliott attitude, which is this, overconfident idiot. Get a Life is like a little more childish. He's like a man child. And then other times he's a kind of adult about it, but he's really like cocky and arrogant, but he's a moron.
Yeah. A lot of my favorite stuff of his from Letterman was, like Morton Downey Jr. or sometimes when we played Brando, but like when he was Morton Downey Jr., he'd be like he was just the most arrogant jerk, but he didn't really have anywhere to go. He didn't know what he was talking about.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us tonight. We got a good one for you tonight. You know, it used to be you go to your local Tasty Freeze for an ice cream cone, and old man Wilson, he'd give you three choices. You can have vanilla, chocolate, or get the hell out of here, you little bastard. I got work to do. I'm not complaining. That's the way it should be. That was the good old days. Nowadays, you go into a 10-story Baskin-Robbins. They got so many flavors in there, by the time you leave, you don't know whether you're a man or a woman. They got your Tootsie Frootsie, your bubblegum sundaes, your peanut butter coffee parfaits. I got to tell you, where the hell are all these flavors coming from? Maybe we should get out our sickles and hammers and find out. Ice cream, there's too many damn flavors. We'll talk about it next on the Chris Elliott Jr. Show.
Like, that part of him is in this character that he plays on Eagle Heart. I mean, he's tough, but he doesn't have much to back himself up.
It's like watching a kid act like a jerk. There's just something you might like about it.
There's an innocence to it where, like, you can tell, like, he doesn't realize he's being a jerk, but he is. And so you kind of have to feel sorry for him.
You know, that's why we originally got so excited working with him. There's no one else alive that does anything like what he does, I don't think.
After a break, my guests talk about how they made Eagle Heart more than just a parody of Walker, Texas Ranger. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International.
Production of Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is supported in part by the menswear blog Put This On, presenting the Put This On Gentlemen's Association. Members receive a handmade pocket handkerchief in the mail every 60 days. More information at putthison.com. And by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
You know what's great? Social media. So social. That's why you should follow us on Twitter at Bullseye. And like us on Facebook. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guests are Michael Coleman, Andrew Weinberg, and Jason Wolliner. They're the creators of Eagle Heart, which airs Thursdays at midnight on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. Let's take a listen to a clip from the show. In this clip, for his next case, the star of the show, Chris Elliott, as his character, Chris Monsanto, is going to have to go deep undercover, and it may require surgery.
Chris, we're going to use all the technology at our disposal to transform you into an old man. Now, the first thing we're going to do is surgically damage your bladder. Now, if it's successful, you should feel the need to urinate about every 30 minutes. Then, we'll cut off your oxygen supply to induce a low-level dementia. Next, we'll hollow out all your bones so that they're nice and brittle. And finally, we'll give you a white wig like an old man. That will be the final touch to complete the transformation.
So tell me about when you sat down and tried to figure out where you wanted to go from this crazy place. When you decided, I don't just want to parody Walker, Texas Ranger, where did you want to go besides, walking, talking, things that grow inside of people's stomachs that are also evil and trying to take over all of us?
One of the things we originally latched onto was the idea of it's starting out on like a criminal case, them some crime going on and them investigating, and then Chris would immediately like get distracted by something or lose interest, and the middle chunk of the show would be Chris doing something completely unrelated, and then it would somehow tie back at the end. And that was like the first episode we shot, not including the pilot, was the Death Punch episode, where it starts with this drug bust. He kills the leader with this death punch, and he feels so bad about it that he moves in with the family, and then it just becomes like a sitcom where, like, this family that hates each other. And then at the end,
he kind of accidentally wanders back into this ridiculous twist and solving this case that, you know, he had forgotten about. And that was like, that was the show that we all were like, okay, this is actually a show that we feel like we haven't seen and we could do fun things with, where it kind of, it's in the first minute, was like this kind of action show, and then it just would become something else.
Because I think our main goal early on was to try to make a show that Chris Elliott would like and that he would want to be in. Everything he's ever made has been very ahead of its time. And,
is,
you know,
Chris Elliott just like a fill-in for your father's?
I think he's probably one of those people that we all sat around like, I don't think anyone ever made me laugh harder than his Letterman stuff. I mean, it'd be like...
Yeah, if you watch that stuff now, or FDR, or Action Family, or Get a Life, like, it's all still so ahead of its time. Like, it still feels so fresh, and, like, it was such an inspiration.
I mean, Chris is, like, 3 years older than Conan, but you don't think of them in the same generation just because Chris was doing so much stuff when he was, like, 21 years old on Letterman.
Jason, you've directed many a thing. You were the director of The Human Giant, a sketch show on MTV, and you directed a series of short films that accompanied the movie Funny People. Tell me a little bit about what kind of directing choices you make on a show like this. Are you simply recreating the aesthetic choices of circa 1992 television action program, or are you doing something different than
that? No, we, on the pilot, when it was kind of those scenes, the action scenes were a direct reference to Walker, I watched a little bit of that and tried to mimic, you know, the way they would edit it and shoot it, and we shot those in like 4:3, so it looked more dated. But, you know, along with everything else, when we started doing the show, we threw out the entire look of the pilot. I brought in a DP I'd worked with a little bit, named Christian Spranger, and we just looked at a lot of like Hitchcock and Coen Brothers and Mad Men, and the way that everything is like kind of very placed and precise and intentional, and a lot of like low angles, which were not always super flattering to actors, but I just think look cooler and give it that kind of that tone that we decided we wanted. And like we built that Marshall's office stage, and I had to really fight for a while to get them to put ceilings on it, because I was like, yeah, you're going to see the ceiling in almost every shot. And the line producer was like, no, you'll never see that. I just throw a camera on your shoulders. Like, no, we won't. We don't want to shoot this show like that. And so, yeah, there was a lot of discussions about the look of it and the feel of it. And I just wanted it to feel different than other comedy that I see on TV.
Tell me a little bit about how making sort of specific stylized aesthetic choices affects the jokes.
I think everything is in service of like the either the writing or the performance, and the style that we've landed on for this show. I think because it isn't a show where the actors like do a lot of improv. We come up with new jokes and lines on set, but we very rarely, because we have to shoot these so fast, it's very rare that we'll be like, okay, just play around with this take and have fun. And everything is very specific, and the cutting is very specific, and timing of everything gets very, very tight. And so I just think the look a lot is kind of set up almost like I was saying in like Coen movies, where everything is kind of put in a very specific place to interact with each other.
I mean, I know the general idea was that we wanted it to look dramatic instead of like...
Yeah, we really just like... silly. We just ripped off Mad Men. We watched a lot of Mad Men, and we're like, let's shoot a comedy like Mad Men, because that show is so funny. And even now that it's back, just watching again, I forgot... Like, I love that show, but I forgot how funny it is. And like Matt Weiner, actually, he worked on a show with Chris, and like the jokes on it are really funny. And I think we just like kind of watched that a lot and wanted to do something similar.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guests are Michael Coleman, Andrew Weinberg, and Jason Wolliner. They're the creators of Eagle Heart, which airs Thursdays at midnight on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. What is the most ambitious single thing you've had to shoot or scene you've tried to shoot?
There's this episode where they go to another planet, which was difficult on our budget.
Yeah.
How did you make a space planet?
Well,
that's the technical term, correct? Space
right.
planet?
Well, that's it's all this guy Dan Butts who did the production design on the show. He's just amazing. Butts. Yeah,
he's amazing. He worked on Mr. Show. He built all their sets and like Drugachusetts and like I mean he's just and he does all the Oscar opening films where they recreate scenes from movies and put Billy Crystal or whatever. And I worked with him a little bit on when Aziz Ansari hosted the MTV Movie Awards. I helped out and Dan did all the sets for those. And just watching him, like he would just watch a movie scene and be able to build the other half of the room and you would compare the shots and it would be identical.
I think like, was it like a day? It was not a lot of advance notice when we wanted him to recreate Jack Lemmon's apartment in The Apartment.
Yeah, we do an episode based on The Apartment this year, and he rebuilt the apartment from The Apartment, and it's amazing.
The titular apartment.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
What's the craziest, stupidest idea that you actually made into TV this year?
I lost perspective on which things are really crazy and really stupid. I mean, objectively, they're probably all...
really stupid. Well, there's one, like the one that you had referenced before, like, just because even to talk about them, I think if anyone's a fan listening, it takes a lot of the fun is seeing where these episodes go minute to minute. But like the one that you'd mentioned before is, basically it starts off, they find a growth in Brett's stomach and they take it out and it's called a Bezoar. And basically it's something that Andrew had seen on, was it My Strange Addiction or?
Yeah, a woman ate, couch cushion. She would carry a couch cushion around with her, unzip it, take off a chunk of that like orange foam and eat it. And then the show took her to a doctor and showed an x-ray and she just had a stomach-shaped clump of couch cushion in her. And they're like, this is called a Bezoar and all this stuff, you're not passing it, just gets stuck there.
And so Andrew was telling us about that, and I think he was out, and then Michael and I kept talking about it, and by the time Andrew came back, we're like, okay, what if they take this Bezoar out of Brett's stomach, and then they decide, like, well, let's, like, let him carry it around for a week, it'll teach him about responsibility, and then you think, oh, okay, I'm watching, like, a take on, like, a Degrassi-style thing where they would carry around, like, an egg or a sack of flour.
Ooh, that horrible smell.
Hey, guys.
What in the hell is that?
That is a Bezoar. It's a mass of indigestible matter that accumulates in the stomach. And this little beauty is made up mostly of hair, poker chips, and chunks of couch cushion.
I'm a daddy.
Okay, Brett, here. We'll destroy that for you.
No! He's become awfully attached to it. Tell you what, why don't you let him take it home, carry it around for a week, and maybe it'll teach him a little something about responsibility.
And then by the next scene, it's, you know, growing. It's like washing machine sized. And so you're like, what's going on? And by the scene after that, it hatches. And then there's like a goopy version of Brett inside who's like this weird alien-like being.
It's another me.
Hello.
Great. Another Brett. Can we get the hairy turd back, please?
Geese Blackham Froomklop.
I beg your pardon.
That means let's go get milkshakes in the new secret friend language I invented just now.
Oh, I see.
I'm going to name you Bezoar.
Okay, folks. Well, this looks like it's going to be a lot of fun.
That's all in the first 4 minutes of the episode. So, and then there's these fake commercials that kind of propel the story forward. And like you said, he's got his own brand of snack treats.
I'm always on the go, and I just don't have time to stop and eat. That's why I love Bezoar Bites. Bezoar Bites are a nutritious, bite-sized snack formulated for today's active lifestyle.
You'll like my bites.
I love the way you describe that. And so it is just like, and that is, I think you can watch that kind of stuff and just feel, hopefully us, you know, just having fun coming up with this stuff and trying to make each other laugh.
Well, Michael, Andrew, Jason, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Bullseye. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you so much
for having us.
Thank you.
Eagleheart airs Thursdays at midnight on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. Every month here on Bullseye, we invite contributor Jordan Morris back onto the program to share his immeasurable expertise at ranking things. What's hot? What's not? He'll tell you. It's Jordan Ranks America.
Still on the list at number 5, it's Blockbuster Video. Out-of-business Blockbusters always have a sign reading, "Store closing, this location only." Sure, guys, this location only. Blockbuster, your optimism is adorable. Holding on at number 4, it's kiwis. Sure, you've heard that kiwis are delicious whether you peel and slice them or eat them with a spoon, but I bet you didn't know that the Chinese call them sun peaches. Out of nowhere at number 3, it's China. Now that it's public knowledge that in China, kiwis are called sun peaches, they're officially the country to beat in 2012. Eyeing the top spot at number 2, it's the guys from work. Sure, these boys are on the straight and narrow at the office, but after they punch out, just try and keep them away from the brewskis and hot wings. Finally, reaching the top of the charts at number 1, it's Die Hard 2. This 1990 action classic is remembered primarily for its amazing stunts, but it's also got some timeless jokes about Bruce Willis not understanding fax machines. From the bottom to the top, I'm Jordan Morris.
Jordan Morris co-hosts the comedy program Jordan Jesse Go with a very handsome young man named Jesse Thorne. You can find it in iTunes or online at MaximumFun.org, though be advised that it is just full of swears, just lots of swear words. You can find Jordan on Twitter at Jordan_Morris. After a break, Rachel Dratch walks into a bar, meets a guy, and 6 months later, she's pregnant. It's all in her new book. It's Bullseye, from MaximumFun.org and PRI. Public Radio, Binternational. Hey, podcast listeners, review our show in iTunes. It makes a big difference, and it only takes a second. I'm waiting for you to do it. You're opening iTunes now. You're typing in Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. You're clicking on review. Now you're clicking on that 5th star. Now you're typing in why the show is so great. Now I'm thanking you. Great work.
Hello there. My name's Graham Clark.
And I'm Dave Shumka.
And together we host a podcast called Stop Podcasting Yourself.
This is a file that you download from the internet and then you listen to it in your pod.
What's that about, you ask? Well, who are you to ask? Who do you think you are?
Yeah, get lost, bozo. We're a couple of stand-up comedians in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And every week we bring a guest on the show. Sometimes they're Canadian, sometimes they're not, sometimes they're a ghost.
It's like you're sitting in on a friend. Afternoon chat.
Plus, we're Canadian, so you get a tax break. You can find us on iTunes or online at MaximumFun.org.
Huh? Ooh.
Spell.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Rachel Dratch, was a cast member of Saturday Night Live from 1999 to 2006, performing signature characters like the classic Hollywood producer Abe Scheinwald, the moment-ruining, sad trombone-inducing Debbie Downer, and Denise Zazu McDonough, the absurdly, thickly accented Southie teen. Here she is alongside Will Ferrell in one of my favorite Saturday Night Live roles, The Lovers.
Would anyone care for some baba ganoush or hummus before we start our main course?
It's so wonderful, Walter, when we're graced with a visit from you.
Well,
I always treasure my conferences at the university and, of course, my time with my old colleagues.
I'm just so glad I got to come along. It's so beautiful here.
Oh, you really must take advantage of the view from Pullman Falls. It's absolutely perfect for lovers' walks.
Yes. Are you taking lovers' walks?
What do you mean?
Well, are you at the point in your relationship where you can walk hand in hand as lovers?
I guess so.
Actually, we haven't been seeing each other all that long.
Oh, I see. So in due time, eh, lover?
Yes, Virginia.
After her run on Saturday Night Live ended, she found herself adjusting to the life of a regular working actress without a steady job for the first time in more than 10 years. She's worked in TV, film, and theater since, with recurring roles on 30 Rock, among other venues. But the biggest change in her life is a baby. In her early 40s, she'd been long-distance dating a boyfriend for a few months when she discovered, much to her shock, that she was pregnant. Her new book, Girl Walks Into a Bar, is about her career, her dating misadventures, and her life as a 40-something new mom. Rachel Dratch, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you. You've just encapsulated my life beautifully. My work here is done.
I can only imagine that there's other stuff other than that.
Not much. You pretty much got it. I think we're done here.
You write a lot and very eloquently, I think, about your improv experience in Chicago, improv and sketch experience, yeah. I should say. And I was reading an interview that you did. I think it seemed like it was right when you had just been cast on Saturday Night Live. And you were describing an improv group that you were in at the Improv Olympic in Chicago, which is a legendary improv theater in Chicago. And it had in it, I'm working from memory, not notes here, but I think it was Matt Besser and Ian Roberts, who both went on to be in the Upright Citizens Brigade. Adam McKay, who also went on to be in the Upright Citizens Brigade and is famous for being Will Ferrell's writing and directing mm-hmm. partner, and wrote on Saturday Night Live for quite a long time. Neil Flynn, who folks might know as the janitor from Scrubs and has also done all kinds of other television acting work. And all of these guys are improv legends. The other thing that struck me about them is that they're all huge Midwestern type dudes.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if they're all actually from the Midwest. Matt Besser, I know, is from Arkansas.
Yeah. Well, they're all very tall and most of them have imposing figures. But I actually think that was good training because I was the only woman on the team. And, you know, it made me, you know, if I wanted to get out and say something, I had to really get out there and say something. So it was a good group to be in.
Something that I really enjoyed reading in your book was, and I don't mean to revel in your misfortune, but was how little you liked attending Dartmouth.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And again, you know, I apologize for enjoying hearing that you didn't enjoy something.
Well, that's where the comedy lies, I guess.
But tell me about how you ended up choosing and going to Dartmouth.
Well, when I walked around, it was like all the guys looked like they were out of an 80s teen movie. And so I was kind of like, oh, this is so cool. But then what I realized when I got there is like it was all like the James Spaders from Pretty in Pink and the Niedermeyers from Animal House. And that I was more of like, you know, the Ducky and the Bluto figure. So, you know, I kind of got sucked in by that like preppy thing. And then I realized, wait a minute, I don't belong here. But I have to say, though, eventually I did like ferret out my kind of people, a.k.a. a lot of closeted gay men.
How did you figure out that comedy was not just the path for you, but was even a path for you?
You know, I started doing improv in college, and I really liked it. And I don't even know what propelled me to Chicago. But we had gone as my improv group. We had gone to sort of check out Chicago, and so I thought I'll just try it and see what Chicago's like. But I didn't have any instant success. It was sort of gradually, like each year, I'd make a little bit more progress. So then that kind of kept me in it. you know, the first thing was like, oh, I got on the house team at Improv Olympics. Then you're in it for another year, you know. And then I got in the touring company of Second City. And then that's your path to getting on the main stage at Second City. So I was in Chicago for 9 years. And I did the main stage for 4 years.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Rachel Dratch. Her new memoir is Girl Walks Into a Bar, Comedy Calamities, Dating Disasters, and a Midlife Miracle. One of Dratch's most recognizable characters from Saturday Night Live is Debbie Downer. Here's a clip from it. Now, the premise of the sketch is pretty straightforward. Debbie Downer is ruining a family trip to Disneyland with her non-winning attitude. But after a few Downer-type comments, the rest of the cast starts to crack. The other players in the sketch include Jimmy Fallon, Fred Armisen, and guest host Lindsay Lohan.
So, hey, who wants to go on Space Mountain with me?
Me!
I want to see the Country Bear Jamboree.
Ooh. I want to go to every country in Epcot and greet them in their own native language. Hola, konnichiwa, hi.
Did you guys hear about that train explosion in North Korea? Media is so sensitive there. So secretive. We may never know how many people perished.
The Saturday Night Live audition has this very specific format, which is you do a certain number of original characters and a certain number of celebrity impressions. And so a lot of people will have spent their whole sketch comedy careers with that in mind and have developed some impressions and characters and then use them on their audition. And if they don't get the part, they're sort of busted. And you're not really an impressionist particularly. So what was it like for you after you had done one round of auditions to come back a year later and have to come back with a whole new set of stuff?
Well, you know, I felt like I'd used the really good stuff the first audition, so then I had my sort of second stringer characters. So I didn't feel quite as good about the characters I brought, but I came back with a lot more impressions than I had the first year. So I don't know, maybe it all balanced out or something.
What were the impressions that you did?
I think I did like Drew Barrymore and Sarah Jessica Parker and, I don't even remember. The first year I did Calista Flockhart, which that was like my one good impression. And then the other ones were kind of like, okay. But, God, I don't remember. Oh, I know. I did Paula Poundstone, if anyone even knows who she is. The comedian, stand-up comic, I did her. And I don't even remember the other ones. It was like 80 years ago.
I like the idea of Saturday Night Live writing a whole string of Paula Poundstone-based sketches.
You know what? I actually did end up doing Around the Show once. In one of those scenes where they have like a bunch, like a string of people come through the door, I actually did do Paula Poundstone.
I mean, and Paula Poundstone has actually been on this show. Paula Poundstone's really funny. But how do you even come to develop an impression of Paula Poundstone?
Because the reason is she's such a random, it's because like you just hear and you're like, oh, I could do that. So then you're like, all right, she's going in the trick bag, you know, that kind of thing, as opposed to someone super famous.
Give me
famous
a set of shoulder pads wide enough.
Shoulder pad, yeah, it's all about the shoulder pads and the necktie.
Did you already have friends working on Saturday Night Live when you went to work on Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, well, Tina was there writing, and Adam was there writing, and Horatio was a cast member, so that's pretty much who I knew.
How did that affect, do you think, that your sort of entrance into that world? It seems like a lot of people kind of drop into it and are overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, I mean, it can be really overwhelming. I'm sure it helped me that, you know, Adam and Tina were there. I mean, I ended up writing a lot with Tina, and she already knew the ropes in terms of, like, the way a scene works at SNL is very different from Second City, because Second City, you can kind of take your time more and develop a character more, and the audience it's more of a theatrical experience. But at SNL, like, someone's going to change the channel. Like, you have to have the jokes out there right away. So Tina knew that in a way that I didn't know it. So she really helped me when I first got there in terms of if I had a character idea. Like, it could be a great character, but I didn't know how to get it into an SNL format scene. So I wrote a lot with her, and I'm sure that helped me greatly. On the flip side, though, like when you get there, it is just kind of sink or swim. Like no matter who you know and whatever, you know, at the end of the day, you're kind of on your own, and you just have to figure out the system by yourself, sort of.
Do you remember the first thing that you got on the air that really worked?
Well, the first thing I got on that I had a part in writing was Sully and Denise, you know, that I wrote with Tina. And it was Tina and I used to do these Boston characters at Second City. So then we brought it to SNL when we both ended up there. That was the first thing that I had a part in writing that really worked.
Is the light flashing? All right, cool. Yo, 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 this is Pat Sullivan in Mr. Nichols' fourth period audiovisual class. For my video project, I'm filming a trip to Burlington Mall with my girl, Denise.
I swear to God, Sully, if you don't get that Burger King breath out of my face, I'm going to get wicked pissed off.
Hey, kids. I'm going to have to ask you not to dry hump by the food products.
Are you the manager?
You flatter me. I'm the assistant manager.
Oh, I wanted to know if you're hiring any holiday help.
We sure are. You kids filming this?
He is. It's a school project. He's not a verbal person, but he is a very visual person.
I got a learning disorder because my mom was a big huffer back in the day.
Well, yes, we are looking for part-timers. Your name?
Denise McDonough. But everybody calls me Zazu!
The schedule of Saturday Night Live is one of the craziest things in the world to me because it is, I think one of the things that's lost because the production is so slick is that it is genuinely a live show that is genuinely almost completely written within the space of a week, written, rehearsed, and performed within the space of a week. And so, you know, sometimes it will be, for people who work on the show, a couple of weeks in a row of working continuously insane hours. And then sometimes also you'll just not be working that week. What was it like to have for that long a job that so dominated, sort of despotically dominated your life?
Well, you kind of get used to it. I mean, you know, it's what you've wanted for, you know, your whole comedy life. So you're psyched to be there when it's like 3 a.m. because it's just, oh my God, I'm on Saturday Night Live. So, you know, you soon learn, like, don't make any plans with outside friends because you'll probably have to break them or you won't feel like keeping them, you know. So, yeah, it's a very nocturnal, intense schedule, but I think that kind of goes with comedy.
Was it hard to shift gears when... Because I mean, from reading the book, I get the impression that it was like a conscious decision when you found yourself outside of that situation and in a life that you were, you know, that you were the boss of, that you were like, you know what, I'm gonna date people on dates.
Well, I just had run out of excuses because I had nothing but time, and so here I was lamenting like, you know, oh, I'm single, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, you know, well, I guess I had to do something about it. But, like, I really had time to date at SNL. I just kind of used SNL as my excuse of why I wasn't really actively pursuing the whole dating scene. Because it kind of made for, like, a comfortable... I mean, I talked about, like, it was my comfort zone. So I didn't have to put myself out there. Because I could just hang with these really funny dudes and my friends from outside. And, you know, I had my whole little... comfortable situation. So why go out with a total stranger?
It seems like a lot of the dating that you did was really just a matter of sort of putting your head and shoulders down and plowing your way through what was left of the dating pool.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I went on some normal dates too, but those normal dates don't make for a funny story. So you write about the ones that, you know, something was a little off about. That's where the laughs lie. Am I right, ladies?
So you actually, I mean, the title of your book, A Girl Walks Into a Bar, comes from the fact that you actually ended up meeting the father of your child at a bar. He was just kind of like a good-looking guy that you ended up chatting to while you were waiting for... a drink order.
Yeah, I went in. We were sitting. I was with my friend. We were sitting outside, and he was just standing next to where I went up to the bar. And I don't know. We just started chatting. Then I had to go back out to my friend. I was like, "Oh, you guys should come join us." So they came and sat outside with us, and that's how it all started.
You started dating this guy, and as you mentioned, he was in town from California. Actually, in town from Mill Valley, if I remember correctly.
Yes. Yeah.
And when you found out that you were pregnant, the two of you had been dating for a matter of months, like 6 months, and dating
6 months, yeah,
and dating long distance. So you know you had a good relationship going, but
well, yeah, I think you know we weren't like, oh my God, I found my soulmate, la la la. We were just more like, you know, we had fun. We he would visit each other. We'd talk on the phone a lot. Like, I don't want to make it seem like, you know, I barely knew the guy, but we had been dating long distance for only 6 months. So, you know, we'd probably spent about a month total in each other's actual presence.
One of the moments that's really intense in the book is you telling your folks that you're pregnant. And, you know, just like anybody's parents, I'm sure they've been bothering you to have to bring them grandchildren for 20 years.
Well, what I said is, like, actually, like, I knew that they would probably want grandkids, but they never really bugged me about it because I think, you know, they knew that it was kind of a spot of, you know, anxiety for me. Like, oh, I'm not going to kid. So they weren't hassling me. But I did think, like, you know, because I was older and I just thought that they had kind of given up on the grandkids thing. And there weren't any grandkids in the family. And so I thought I was going to come in with this great news and they were going to be like all excited. But actually they were just more kind of like stunned. They kind of looked at me like, her? And so I left, as I said in the book, I left feeling like Juno because I felt a little bit like I was 16 and telling my parents I got pregnant or something.
And not that they were like, they came around super pretty shortly thereafter.
Oh yeah, they're like in love. But yeah, like, you know, they were very supportive, but I think in that moment it wasn't the reaction I was expecting.
What was the thing that happened to you, especially, you know, at the beginning that you least expected, that you were least able to plan for?
Well, you know what's weird? The actual thing it was sort of a flip around. Like, I was most surprised by how well everything went. I mean, in terms of John and me dealing with a newborn, and like, it was just kind of a strange, positive experience. I mean, yeah, you know, you get no sleep and blah, blah, but I was kind of used to no sleep from SNL. And like, I was always a night person. And so I wasn't like, that didn't throw me at all, the no sleep thing. And then I don't know, like, we were both just together in this really actually cool way when you think of our circumstance. So that was probably the most, you know, pleasantly surprising part of it. And then beyond that, although I do talk in the book about like trying to be in any sort of seduction mode or flirtation mode, I should say, like when, you know, you're hooked up to a breast pump, it's like all the mystique is just gone. And there's a lot of like, you know, there's a lot of that in the book of just being like, you know, looking your worst, stripped down and you're, you know, you're inner animal core and you're with this person that like 6 months ago you were like, hey, can I get you a drink? I mean, it's like, that was like the funniest yet surreal part of the whole story, I guess. And then, you know, I didn't have really many jobs going on, so I had a lot of time to throw myself into the whole mom thing. So that turned out to be a fun thing instead of a bad thing.
Well, Rachel Dratch, a thousand congratulations and thanks for joining us on Bullseye.
Thank you.
Rachel Dratch's new book is A Girl Walks Into a Bar, Comedy Calamities, Dating Disasters, and a Midlife Miracle. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Every week we close the show with a recommendation from yours truly. It's The Outshot. Some records are just easy to listen to. They're the ones you reach for over and over. You get something out of them every time. They feel right no matter what the circumstances. They're vibrant. That's what I love about Les McCann and Eddie Harris's album, Swiss Movement. The It was recorded live at the Montreux Jazz Festival in 1969. I don't think that anyone at the time could have reasonably expected that it would become a hit. I mean, it was a live jazz record, for one thing. But it did. The band hadn't even played together before. I think that freshness, a live record of what was basically an impromptu band, is part of what makes the album so great. It just feels alive, like a great party. And part of what makes it so fresh is that they were creating a genre, too. The opening track, compared to what was the first soul jazz hit. It's a protest song, but it's the kind of protest song that makes you want to invite some friends over and have a protest good time.
The president, he's got his war. Folks don't know just what it's for. Nobody gives us a rhyme or reason. Half a one doubt, they call it treason. We're chicken feathers all the way out wonder.
Come on, you can't tell me you're not having a party right now.
Trying to make it real compared to what suck you to me.
That's my out shot.
Sunday sleep and nod, trying to duck the wrath of God. Preachers filling us with fright. They all trying to teach us what they think is right. They really got to be some kind of nut. I can't use it. I'm trying to make it real compared to what.
That's it for Bullseye this week. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Julia Smith is our producer, Nick White our editor. Our interns are Joe Molinelli and Justin Morissette. Our theme music, Huddle Formation, by the Go Team. Thanks to them and their label Memphis Industries for letting us use that. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org. You can email me if you have thoughts about the show, Jesse@MaximumFun.org. And remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign. Special thanks this week to Jason Isaac at WNYC for engineering the New York side of our Rachel Dratch interview.
Production of Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is supported in part by the menswear blog Put This On, presenting the Put This On Gentlemen's Association. Members receive a handmade pocket handkerchief in the mail every 60 days. More information at putthison.com. And by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.